Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yes. Well, Russell understands he's got a sexual addiction. You know why? Because he cannot stop. And when you can't stop the behavior, that is the number one indicator for whether you've got sexually compulsive behaviors which lead to sexual addiction. So if you're listening to the show, you either do have a sexual addiction, you wonder if you have a sexual addiction, your partner or family member has a sexual addiction, or you're questioning that right now. And I want you to know I'm here to help. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, Carol the Coach, and this is the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show that specifically deals with sexual addiction. And I got to tell you, it is the only show on iTunes that brings you the up-and-coming information that will help you to both understand the diagnosis and figure out how to manage it. And, you know, we have experts all over the world that call in and give us their opinions about what are some of the classic signs, what are some of the conjoint actual diagnostic criteria that coincides with the sexual addiction. You know, when you have a sexual addiction, are you more prone to have other issues? And that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. I am so pleased that we've had him on the show once before. We have Dr. Jeff Goodman. He's a licensed clinical psychologist and a CSAT. For any of you who've been listening to the show, you know that means he's a certified sex addiction therapist, just like myself. And he's the professor of psychology at Long Island University. He has 22 years of experience, and he's been writing and helping adults and children understand their feelings better and find their unique path of recovery. He lives in New York with his wife, Valita, his daughter, Carolyn, and his cat, Savannah. So this is, let me tell you, I've never had somebody tell me about their cat. His Savannah cat, Nala. Now, I can relate to that because right now I've got my dog, he's really still a puppy, Boo Bear, on my lap. You know, when my husband's home, I make Boo stay downstairs with my husband. It's not appropriate for him to be on the show. But when nobody's home, Boo goes crazy. So he is also a guest here on the show, sitting on my lap, hanging out with me. He's never been obnoxious, so we'll just hope that he isn't today. As we talk about something that actually is kind of near and dear to my heart, because it is such a tough diagnosis. You know, sex addicts and or their partners typically have a dual diagnosis. Maybe they have alcoholism or substance abuse. Maybe they've got depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, anxiety. And tonight we're going to be talking about something called borderline personality disorder, BPD, borderline personality disorder, can be associated with sex addiction. And, you know, it is difficult to diagnose and treat because oftentimes some of the diagnostic criteria for sexual addiction looks like borderline, and some of the criteria diagnoses for borderline looks like sex addiction. So Dr. Goodman is going to be talking about the trauma that is typically underneath this diagnosis and why someone would create a maladaptive coping mechanism like sexual addiction to deal with it. Now, that's for the sex addict, but I got to tell you, oftentimes we hear that some sex addicts have narcissistic personality disorder. And we don't know why, but narcissists end up partners who have borderline personality disorder. So, you know, if you've wondered what is going on with you, this is the show to find out, is there a dual diagnosis? Whether you be a partner or an addict, are you suffering from borderline personality disorder, or do you love somebody who has that disorder? And then what do you do about it? What programs can you be a part of? What medications can you use? And which problem should be treated first? The sex addiction, the borderline personality disorder, or both simultaneously? So I'm looking forward to meeting with him because I'm telling you, there are some people that steer away from borderline personality disorder. And I'll tell you why. Because so oftentimes, if you have a patient that suffers from this, they're constantly pushing you away. They're kind of saying, come here, I need you, love me, care for me, help me. And then they're going, stay out of my face. You're not worth my time. I'm out of here. And so you have to be a therapist who can Teflonize themselves so that they don't take it personally and they learn how to handle this person that has a trauma. So again, we're going to be excited to be talking about that. Now, I just got an email, and it was from a person who has worked, you know, with me via email, now for a year or so. I'm going to call him Kyle, of course, so that he can be anonymous. And he said, hey, Carol, getting better for me. I wanted to tell you that I'm seeing some of the promises from the Big Book coming true. My job is going better. I now have a few good friends, both inside and out of my 12-step group, which is SA for Kyle, and I'm learning to meditate. I'm finally on track to lose those pesky 30 to 40 pounds above my healthy weight. Boy, and I'm exercising regularly. I am gratefully sober, and I'm learning to bring the awareness developing in my own mindfulness practice into daily life. I am better armed to meet my recovery. And boy, that's what it's all about. You heard me say last week when we talked about what works, that you've got to do a variety of things. And it's so important that as you work on your recovery, you also make a decision to work on your healthy behaviors. And that's why when Kyle says, hey, I've got some extra friends, I say hip, hip, hooray, because truly, sex addicts are oftentimes socially isolated. Now, interestingly enough, he has been using the SA Daily Sobriety Renewal. Now, what that is an important tool that gives consistent contact and support and keeps him out of isolation. He cites, actually, some Toltec teachings of Don Miguel Ruiz. And I think you've heard me talk about this guy, Don Miguel Ruiz. If you get on my Facebook, you'll see that I just recently went to a book signing of his son, Don Jose Ruiz, who basically has written this book that I just finished. And it's a tribute to his father. The Four Agreements is this incredible, small, tiny book from the Toltec teachings that says, you know, if you work on these four philosophies, you will have a happy life. Now, I have to admit, when you're an addict, be it a drug addict, an alcoholic, a sex addict, an overeater's addict, an overspending addict, there's a little bit more that you have to do. But I want you to think about these four things, and you tell me if you believe that you make it happen. The four agreements are, one, you never make assumptions. You check things out. When you believe something and you hear somebody talking about it, you check it out with them. If you're questioning something, you don't keep it inside. You check it out. You never make assumptions because oftentimes our assumptions come from our childhood of origin issues, and we don't get it right, so you don't make assumptions. The second teaching is do your personal best. Nothing more and nothing less. In other words, you know, don't try to be perfect, but don't be a slacker either. Do your personal best. And that's why I say to people, work your recovery tools. And don't tell me you can't do them, because I know that you can. And if you don't, you won't get as much out of recovery. And if you do, you'll make the most of recovery. The third tool is to be impeccable with your word. And what that means is be honest, have integrity, don't gossip, don't say mean-spirited things. Now think about that for a minute. Is the core of sexual addiction recovery, is it not, to be honest and have integrity? Addicts have learned how to lie. So I don't call them liars, but they call themselves liars. They say, you know what, we have lived our life in a lie, and we can't trust ourselves until we get into recovery, work the 12 steps, figure out what it takes to be honest. Honest with ourselves, and then, of course, honest with others. So work a strong recovery program and be impeccable with your word. Be honest. The last one I love. It is to not take conflict personally. Now, boy, that's a tough one for addicts, because addicts are oftentimes, they are overwhelmed with shame. And to be overwhelmed with shame means that when something happens, they go to that dark place that says that they're no good. I don't know if that's happened to you, if you're an addict, or if you have a partner, an addict. If you're a partner and you have this addict partner and you watch him or her go right to shame when something bad has happened. But I always say guilt is healthy. Shame is not. Shame creates self-loathing. Guilt says, hey, there's something not right. Let's get it fixed. So those are the four agreements. And again, if you've got a piece of paper and a pen, write them down. They are, be impeccable with your word. Don't take conflict personally. Do your personal best. And don't make assumptions. And Kyle says that he's really been working the Toltec teachings of Don Miguel Ruiz. And it has helped him to reframe his core identity, and it's given him new tools for living. It has better helped him to accept his new feelings, whether positive or painful. And he doesn't allow those feelings to destroy him or overpower him. And, you know, last week we talked about feelings. If you didn't get to hear the show, go back to it. I talked about the five primary feelings and how you can work with them. You know, things and persons trigger feelings. And Kyle says, I create them based on my agreements about what those triggers mean. I can accept the feelings and feel them, but I can also question them and their basis. I'm learning to create my emotional state at will, separate myself from my surroundings. I can choose to enter a state of gratitude. I can choose to express love. I can accept the feelings that intrude or arise, but not be swept up or terrorized by them. And wow, that is amazing stuff when you can take a situation and look at it so objectively and know that you have choices. So I highly recommend the Four Agreements because it really can take you to a place where they're easy life skills that you can consistently work on. I promise you, if you get the book, you can read it in an afternoon. It is not a huge book. It's a small book, but it has a lot of meaning. So tonight, I'm going to be talking with Jeff Goodman. And again, Dr. Goodman is, you know, an amazing speaker. He has written books himself, and he's going to be talking to us about borderline personality disorder. So, Dr. Goodman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me tonight.
Absolutely. And boy, you have decided to take on a topic that can be very perplexing to both therapists and patients alike, borderline personality disorder. Let me ask you something. What do you think BPD is, and how would you describe it?
Well, borderline personality disorder is a diagnostic category in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's been around for quite a while. Authors first started writing about it in the 1960s, 50s and 60s. It became somewhat of a hot topic back then because it was relatively new. People who would now be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, back then it was thought that they might have beginning symptoms of schizophrenia, and they were treated as such. But because of some authors like Otto Kernberg and others, they were classed in a different diagnosis, which was later known to be a personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder, to define it, would be a pervasive pattern of instability. What kind of instability? Well, it would be instability in relationships, interpersonal relationships, in one's self-image, in one's emotional life, and in their impulsivity. So it's actually a disorder that's amazingly stable in its instability. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that as a person demonstrates instability in various areas of their lives, that pattern of instability can last a very, very long time. Borderline personality disorder tends to show itself by early adulthood and can last for the duration of one's life, although more recent longitudinal studies suggest that this kind of instability tends to level off in one's 40s, early mid to late 40s, the disorder tends to level off a little bit. But it shows itself in a variety of contexts, and it's been known to be extremely difficult to treat. Although there are some evidence-based treatments that have been specifically designed for borderline personality disorder, I'm sure that we'll get into that later on.
Absolutely. And you have said that, you know, oftentimes inexperienced clinicians may have some trouble teasing out sexual addiction from borderline personality disorder and vice versa. So how would you describe sexual addiction?
Well, sex addiction actually has some overlap with borderline personality disorder. You know, sex addiction is it's a pattern of behavior as well, mm-hmm. characterized by powerlessness over one's sexual desires and behaviors, and an unmanageability around those behaviors. And it's a compulsion to continue sexual behavior in spite of the adverse consequences that might come someone's way. So that's how I would define sex addiction.
Okay, well, that totally makes sense. Now, obviously, you've said they overlap to some degree, and that's what makes it very, very tough. How did you become interested in studying BPD?
Well, I became interested in it in two different ways. In one way, I have a family member who suffers from borderline personality disorder, so I had an interest in it just from a very personal experience of it. And secondly, I had a wonderful opportunity to study with one of the pioneers of borderline personality disorder, Otto Kernberg, for 2 years in a postdoctoral fellowship at what's now known as New York Presbyterian Hospital here in New York. And, you know, it was just a wonderful learning experience where I worked with patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder for 2 years on an inpatient unit. And these patients had been admitted to the hospital because they had engaged in suicidal behaviors, self-injurious behaviors, and couldn't stop themselves. And a lot of them had substance abuse issues, and some of them were very sexually promiscuous and had, you know, sex addiction type of issues. So, it was, you know, it's hard to tease apart these two different diagnoses. But that's how I got into it in the first place, from a personal experience with a family member and then getting this opportunity for 2 years to work with borderline patients in an inpatient setting.
Well, that was really something that you would get to work with one of the masters and also see it in your own family and get to understand it from that perspective, too. That really helps you to personalize it and also gives you some special devotion to that disorder in and of itself. Most of us have somebody in our lives, whether it be family or friend, that has borderline personality disorder, so it can be very, very tough to deal with. I know that I oftentimes recommend the book, I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, and there are many mm-hmm. good books. We'll be talking about what you might recommend later on. Tell me, what do you believe are some of the root causes for borderline personality disorder?
It's a complex disorder, and there have been a lot of studies to try to pinpoint exactly how does it begin. As I said earlier, it generally begins by early adulthood, and oftentimes it can be recognized even earlier than that. I am not only a clinician myself, but I'm also a professor at Long Island University, and I supervise doctoral students on some of their treatment cases. And I supervised a student on a child who was 8 years old, and it was very, very clear that she had all the telltale signs of borderline personality disorder, and she was only 8 years old. Now, technically, one can't officially diagnose borderline personality disorder until the person is 18. But there are clear signs of the disorder much earlier than that. And as I said, one of the criteria of the disorder is that the criteria need to emerge, you know, by early adulthood. So it's something that's very, very pervasive, and there have been a lot of studies to try to understand exactly how it forms. And the best guess that we can come up with is that it is a mixture of a genetic predisposition toward the disorder. So, for example, borderline personality disorder runs in families. If you have it, chances are that, you know, you had a parent or an aunt or uncle or a grandparent who had the disorder. And also, it's also caused by traumatic events. Now, it could be traumatic events, like singular events, such as maybe a horrific sexual abuse episode in middle childhood, but it doesn't have to be. There is a common myth out there, I think, that borderline personality disorder is caused by sexual abuse. And it's true that some borderline patients were sexually abused as children, but certainly not all. And so we need to understand how this disorder comes about in people who weren't sexually abused. So there's been some research to suggest that the disorder comes about through disrupted and insecure attachment relationships with a caregiver. So, for example, if you've had a caregiver all throughout your infancy, early childhood, etc., who is inconsistent, sometimes they're there for you, sometimes they're not. You can't really count on them to be there all the time. That can be trigger for borderline personality disorder, or what's known as a disorganized attachment, where the caregiver might be abusive or frightening in some way to an infant or a toddler. Those early childhood experiences can come back to haunt the individual later in childhood. And we can talk about some of the actual symptoms or criteria of borderline personality disorder, but the etiology seems to have a very early onset in early childhood, perhaps even infancy. In these early attachment relationships, when they form, how they form, and what kind of caregiving experiences the child has had, those caregiving experiences can have a profound impact on whether or not a person develops the actual syndrome of borderline personality disorder.
Well, you know, you just had referenced a little bit about the criteria for borderline personality disorder, but if you were working with a client in your practice, what might he or she look like?
Well, you know, interestingly, even though borderline personality disorder is in the DSM, which is the, you know, the diagnosing Bible, so to speak, for psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers, it's really not a monolithic diagnosis. What you need, there are 9 criteria for borderline personality disorder, and I can, you know, review them briefly. And you need to have or meet the threshold for 5 out of those 9 criteria. Now, you can meet the criteria in any number of different combinations. So you might have criteria 1, 2, 7, 8, and 9, or you might meet criteria for 3, 7, 6, 8, and 9, or, you know, any different combination can put you over the threshold for borderline personality disorder. So the research suggests that there tend to be different subtypes of borderline personality disorder. But in general, borderline personality disorder consists of 9 criteria. The first one is frantic attempts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. So efforts to stick with a partner, a loved one, a family member at all costs, no matter how poorly you're being treated, you're going to stick with that relationship because you're terrified of living without it. And I think that criterion actually speaks a lot to some of the partners of sex addicts whom we treat in our practices. The second criterion is a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships.
Now, can I stop you right there for one
second?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because obviously that attachment you were talking about, the very first criteria, you said sometimes speaks to the partners of sex addicts. Say just a little bit more about that, because this show has a lot of partner listeners.
Yeah, well, you know, the partners of sex addicts sometimes, not always, but sometimes have their own issues, which draw them to the profile of a sex addict. And so they might be dating a sex addict, or they might be married to a sex addict, and they eventually find the courage to get out of that relationship, or the sex addict breaks up with them and they date somebody else, and turns out that person is also a sex addict. How uncanny is that? But the partners often find it extremely difficult to extricate themselves from these kinds of relationships because in some cases, they also have borderline personality disorder, and abandonment is terrifying. Now, no one wants to lose a loved one, no matter how emotionally disturbed they might be, whether they're addicted to whatever substance or behavior. It's very difficult to lose somebody you love. But for these particular folks, the end of a relationship like that feels like a death. Their own death. And so to avoid that feeling, they will engage in these frantic efforts to avoid having that happen. And they'll often do anything it takes to maintain that relationship, no matter how unhealthy it might be for them, because they're terrified of the alternative. What's the alternative? To be without that person. And that to them is the equivalent of dying. And so those individuals who feel that way about the loss of a relationship, you know, might want to consider getting into treatment. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that they have borderline personality disorder, but it's an issue of concern, and a professional would need to evaluate them to see whether they have, you know, 4 of the other 9 criteria, whether they meet those other criteria, because it's not, you can't base the diagnosis just on one criterion.
Well, absolutely, but if I understand you correctly, you're really saying that a partner who perhaps has been with an addict, who's not recovered, so there's not as much success in their relationship, and they're re-traumatized, may wonder, what is wrong with them? Are they crazy? Why are they putting up with this? And ultimately what you're saying is it's not just about the behavior of their partner, but it's also about the core issues that were never met as a kid. And because they have this person in their life, they're too afraid to be without it because they didn't get what they needed as a kid.
That's exactly right. And so from the outside, it might appear that they're just acting crazy, or you know, they want to be abused, you know, but these issues go back a long, long, long way in a person's history. And unless we were actually there from the beginning, we don't know what shoes a person has walked in. And I'm telling you, with these patients who have borderline personality disorder, they've walked in shoes that would be very terrifying for the rest of us to walk in, with caregivers who are extremely inconsistent or even abusive and frightening.
Well, that makes total sense, and that's why you encourage them to get to a professional who has expertise with sexual addiction and borderline personality so that they get an accurate diagnosis and get the help that they need, the support that they need.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Well, what is the second criteria? I interrupted you in the middle of that.
That's okay. The second criterion is a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships. So often when a patient is trying to avoid, you know, abandonment, their relationships become very unstable. And the fear that they have about a partner leaving them
mm-hmm.
creates for a lot of intensity in those kinds of relationships. The third criterion is identity disturbance. So an unstable self-image or a sense of self, not really knowing who one is or what one's goals or aims are in life. And this can include even certain areas of one's personality that one might think would be fairly stable by the time someone becomes an adult, for example, sexual orientation. You know, a patient diagnosed with borderline personality disorder might believe that they're heterosexual and then suddenly think that they're homosexual for a few weeks and then look back and say, no, I don't think I really am. I think I'm really heterosexual. And so even in areas where most of us might believe that's a fairly stable trait in our personalities, these folks really don't know who they are. And so even something as seemingly stable as sexual orientation might throw them off and might make them fairly confused, not knowing what direction to go to. Like one day they might wake up and say, I want to be a veterinarian. And then 2 weeks later say, I don't know why I wanted to be a veterinarian. I'd actually like to be a sanitation worker. Just not really knowing who they are. So that's the third criterion. The fourth criterion, which has a lot of bearing, I think, on the overlap between sex addiction and borderline personality disorder, is impulsivity in at least 2 areas that are potentially self-damaging. And, of course, one of those areas that are listed here in criterion 4 is sex, so sexual behavior. So impulsivity and sexual behavior is one of these 2 areas, or one of these areas that are potentially self-damaging and would satisfy the criterion for this, for criterion 4. Other areas could be spending. So impulsivity and spending, so shopaholism, substance abuse is another area of impulsivity, reckless driving, and binge eating. So what you have there are a whole list of behaviors that potentially could be addictive. So I think that there's a lot of overlap between this criterion and what we think of when we think of sex addiction. Fifth criterion is recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures, or threats, or self-mutilating behavior. So cutting oneself, burning oneself, these are behaviors that would satisfy the criterion, this criterion number 5. The sixth criterion is affective instability due to a marked reactivity of mood. And what that means is that there are these episodes that individuals go through. They could be very sad and depressed for a few hours or maybe a few days, and then suddenly become very anxious and worrying about the future and wondering whether they're going to live. And then that can turn into irritability. And they can become very angry at people around them or angry at themselves. And these mood shifts can be very rapid. So that's the sixth criterion. The seventh criterion is chronic feelings of emptiness, feeling like there's really nothing inside of them, that they're just a hollow shell. And often this feeling goes along with a feeling of boredom. And we know from studying sex addiction that feelings of boredom are often what partly, anyway, drives individuals into, you know, sexually acting out behavior. Criterion 8, inappropriate intense anger, difficulty controlling anger. These kinds of feelings tend to come out more so with individuals whom the person knows and knows well and has an emotional attachment to. It's often the case that a patient with borderline personality disorder behaves this way with their therapist. And you think to yourself, well, why would they treat their therapist that way? The therapist is trying to help them. Well, some people tend to think that patients with this diagnosis are testing the therapist. They want to see whether the therapist is going to leave them, even when they get angry. Is the therapist there for them? So it's very important that a therapist who treats a borderline person treats them with compassion and patience, even when they're being verbally abused by the patient. It's very important that the therapist weather those storms. We can get into that later when we talk about therapy strategies. But the ninth criterion is transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. Well, what does that mean? Well, in some cases, with some patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, they can become suspicious of other people, and they can become somewhat unaware of their surroundings for short periods of time, maybe a few hours or so. And usually this happens when, as I've been saying all along, their attachment to a significant other is threatened in some way. They can dissociate, meaning they can really leave themselves for a period of time and not really pay attention to their surroundings, and also become very suspicious that people are trying to hurt them or you know, get rid of them in some way, abandon them, even when it's not true. So those are the nine criteria for borderline personality disorder.
And so obviously there's some unique issues the patient's suffering from these kind of criteria experience in addition to sexual addiction. And so many people, so many therapists don't know how to deal with sexual addiction and don't want to deal with borderline personality because it has such a come-here-go-away aspect to it. Now, you took it upon yourself to do some research and to study. Why do you think clients with this disorder oftentimes push people away only to bring them back into their lives?
Well, it's an interesting dilemma, isn't it? Here are patients who are seeking help. They clearly are in a lot of distress. I mean, these patients, what I've learned in those 2 years working with inpatients who were diagnosed with borderline personality disorder is that they are suffering. I mean, they are clearly distressed. So then why would these individuals push away their therapists, the very people who are trying to help them? And this happens over and over and over again. And I think one way of explaining this phenomenon is that these patients are so terrified that their therapist is going to abandon them at some point, because that's what they know, that's what they're familiar with, that they want to engage in what I would call a preemptive strike. They want to preemptively reject the therapist to see what the therapist is going to do. If the therapist stays with them, then they have more confidence that no matter how they behave, this therapist is going to stick with them through thick and thin. They're not going to abandon them. If the therapist doesn't appreciate that and retaliates in some way, either verbally or maybe passive-aggressively by missing sessions with the patient is going to get the sense, okay, this guy or this woman is like every other person in my life. They're going to abandon me. They can't handle me. I'm going to leave. And borderline patients, if they're not handled properly, you know, will leave a treatment, even though they're in desperate straits. And so that's why I think it's very important that clinicians who treat patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, comorbidly, let's say, with sex addiction, they need to get specialized training with these folks, because if you handle it incorrectly, these patients will retaliate and in some ways very destructive ways against themselves. So they will hurt themselves in order to hurt you, the therapist. And so it's very important that the therapist handle these cases very compassionately, but also in very intelligent ways, ways that have worked for people who are, you know, very well versed in working with this population of people. And so it's important that therapists get specialized training, I feel, in borderline personality disorder, because if you don't, you're running the risk of something disastrous possibly happening. Because this particular population of individuals, as I said before, will, you know, are prone to hurting themselves if they feel as though they're going to be abandoned.
Well, that makes sense. And in some ways, you called it something a little bit different, and I believe it reflects kind of a trauma reenactment. You know, they experienced that as a child, so they create that again to see if indeed you're going to stick. And
exactly.
So obviously it's a test, and that's why it's so important not to take it personally, but to hang with the client, be it the sex addict or the partner, to say, you know, I'm here through the duration, and I'm going to work with you no matter what, no matter how you treat me, to some degree.
Exactly. I mean, you use the word "it's a test," and I think that you hit the nail on the head. It is a test, and the patient is scrutinizing your behavior as a therapist to see whether you pass the test or you fail the test. And if you demonstrate to the patient that you might not be there for them in the end, that you're going to abandon them just like everybody else, they're going to leave, and then you're not going to be able to help them, and they're going to go on and maybe hurt themselves. So it's just so important that therapists get specialized training with these folks, because we want to be able to help them. And the good news here, it sounds so dire, you know, but the good news is that these folks can be treated. There is treatment out there for them, and these treatments have been shown to be effective, and there is hope and promise for these folks. So it's not like it's all doom and gloom and these people are going to hurt themselves if you just sneeze the wrong way. There is help for them.
Well, again, it can be very difficult to understand this kind of behavior, and yet when you do understand that it's coming from childhood issues, it's easier to see and accept the behavior. So let's just say that an addict has a partner who has borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
That addict probably also needs to be in therapy to deal with his wife or her husband's borderline personality. I mean, that is not something that the layperson can typically handle on their own.
No, absolutely not. It would be a grave mistake to think that a loved one could, just of their own love, you know, you can't love a patient diagnosed with borderline personality disorder out of the disorder. You can't love someone out of it. Although people would like to try, it's just, and I know from personal experience, it's not the way to go. It doesn't work that way. You can't love somebody out of this, because you just can't give enough to these folks. It's a bottomless well that they feel that they can never be truly filled up with enough love. And that's part of that chronic feelings of emptiness. And so it's really a syndrome that really needs to be treated by a professional in a professional setting, where there are clear limits set on behavior and there's a contract in place. You know, there are four different treatments that are evidence-based that have been tested in trials that have been shown to be effective. And all four of them, they're different in their own ways, but all four of them are similar in the sense they're highly structured treatments. What borderline patients need very much in their treatments is structure. And all four of these treatments have healthy doses of structure in all of them. And those...
And are you referencing didactic, behavioral therapy? What are some of the treatments?
Okay, so there are four different treatments that have been shown to be effective in what's known as randomized controlled trials. It's just a fancy way of saying that these treatments have been effective over and above a treatment as usual, a treatment that a borderline patient would normally get. So the four treatments are mentalization-based therapy,
okay,
transference-focused psychotherapy, so it's MBT, mentalization-based therapy, TFP, transference-focused psychotherapy, DBT, which is what you had referenced a couple of seconds ago, dialectical behavior therapy, and the fourth one is schema-focused therapy, SFT, a lot of three-letter symbols for these treatments. But and they're all different in their own way. I suppose of the four, the most popular one is dialectical behavior therapy. That's the one that's been around probably longer than the other ones. I was trained in TFP, that's transference-focused psychotherapy, with Otto Kernberg during my postdoctoral fellowship. And then later on, I did also receive training in mentalization-based therapy. I was not trained in dialectical behavior therapy, but that's probably the most popular of the four. But as I said, and they treat the borderline patient from slightly different angles, slightly different theoretical perspectives. But what holds them all together in my mind is this emphasis on structure, compassion, patience, weathering the storm of the patient, the emotional storm. I had talked about, you know, emotional instability in these patients, you know, weathering those shifts in mood and not becoming rattled by those shifts, but just keeping an even keel even when the patient's going through a storm, an affective storm. Those general techniques are extremely important in treating this population. So all four of these actually have that in common, this high structure that these patients need in order to thrive.
Well, that makes sense. And part of that is the structure, the predictability. They feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
They know what to expect. Nothing's going to be sprung on them. It has rules, it has structure, it has support built in. Now, that why 12 steps are not necessarily, the 12-step program is not enough necessarily for the recovery of a sex addict who has borderline personality.
Well, that's exactly right. And you used the word predictability. I think that's a perfect word to use. Because think about what I said earlier about what they were not getting as young children, as infants and toddlers. They were, evidence suggests that these individuals as very, very young children were being cared for by inconsistent caregivers. Now, what does inconsistent mean? Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. Well, that's the definition of unpredictability. And so if they know only unpredictability, what do we as therapists need to give them? Well, we need to give them predictable environments to counteract the unpredictable environments they had as young children. So I think predictability is key to the success of these four treatments that I identified. And I think it's just key. Now, 12-step programs are interesting. They're also very highly structured. You know, if you've been to a 12-step program, you know the structure that's involved. You have the preamble. You read the 12 steps. You read this preamble in every meeting. There's the sharing time. There's the business portion. There's the serenity prayer at the end. You know, it's a very highly structured experience. The problem is that it's a group. And often patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder get something out of these groups, but it's not enough because they're not getting that one-on-one attention. It's a group setting, and so there's a proneness, I think, on the part of patients with borderline personality disorder to feel like, well, you know, Johnny is not paying attention to me, and that hurts my feelings, and so I'm never coming back. Or Veronica's over there, and she's talking with one of her friends, and she's not talking to me, and that makes me feel bad about myself. I hate this group. I'm leaving. So because it's not one-on-one, I don't think it meets all the needs that a 12-step program typically offers most individuals. There's more to the symptoms of BPD that can't be really adequately addressed by a 12-step program. Now, of course, the patient can get a sponsor, so that's one-on-one. That's true. The problem with that is that most sponsors aren't trained mental health professionals, and I think they can be easily burned out by a patient diagnosed with borderline personality disorder because they're not really trained in how to deal with that. And so the unsuspecting sponsor can be hit over the head with these push-me-pull-you kind of actions that the borderline patient takes with most people and feel like, hell, I don't want to sponsor you anymore. And then that gives the message, that sends the message to the borderline patient, you know, well, no one's caring enough. No one loves me enough. I'm dropping the 12-step program. But if that person were in therapy with somebody who is caring, I think as an adjunct to that, 12-step programs can be extremely helpful for these folks, but only if they're already in their own therapy.
That makes sense, too. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, and oftentimes people with borderline personality say, is there any medication that can help me? What is your belief about medication and borderline personality disorder?
It's so interesting. Most disorders, if you talk to a psychiatrist, you know, most disorders have a medication. They seem to have identified a medication for that disorder. Interestingly, there is no medication that either treats the symptoms of BPD or cures it. Now, there is evidence to suggest that depression is highly comorbid with borderline personality disorder, meaning that in a large percentage of people with this disorder, they also feel depressed and would satisfy criteria for depression. And if they are prescribed medication for the depression, so some kind of antidepressant like an SSRI or something like that, that can lift the depression, which can actually help them maybe to adjust better to therapy and get better help for themselves. So in some cases, borderline individuals could benefit from medication if it's treating their depression, which often goes along with and accompanies borderline personality disorder. But there is no medication that directly targets borderline personality disorder. It's only through psychotherapy approaches that the disorder can be effectively treated.
Well, Dr. Jeff Goodman, I thank you so much for sharing your wisdom about borderline personality and sexual addiction. If people want to get a hold of you, how can they do that?
Well, there are several ways. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a professor in the clinical psychology doctoral program at Long Island University, and they can look up Long Island University and find me there.
Okay.
Just Google, or they could Google my name. I have a website, and it's a fairly long website address, but people can just email me, and I'd be happy to get back to them. I field email messages every day from people, and I'm happy to do that. It's ggoodman@liu.edu. So it's GGOO. B as in David, M as in Mary, A, N as in Nancy, @liu.edu. That would probably be the best way.
Well, thank you so much. We have to end the show, but you have been informative as usual, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Carol the Coach Show, and we'll see you next week.